same time, the light from the sun, the particles from the sun, will do the same. And also, the light does not have a mass. Back to you.
Let me try this one on you, Wesley. Let's assume that I've made a spark gap in the room in front of you right now. And you've turned off the lights in the room, and you see the light coming out of that spark gap. I've exceeded the 30 kilovolts per centimeter, and I'm getting light out of it. Tell me what's making that light.
Different in potentials.
Go one step further. Where is the light coming from? The 30,000 volts per centimeter makes current flowing through ionized air, which is a plasma. That plasma is giving me light. Where's the light coming from?
From the mechanical change of the particles of the air through which that electrical charge was jumping to.
I got two guesses as to where the light is coming from in a spark gap. Number one, the conduction of the current through that plasma is heating up the plasma to some very high temperatures. A few thousand degrees centigrade are the individual air molecules in that spark gap. And anything that is at 5,000 degrees centigrade will give out white light. That's what the surface of the sun does. That's one mechanism. Pure black body radiation of a hot material gives off light. Second of all, a tremendous number of those ionized particles that are in that spark gap are deionizing. Because the air molecules are packed in so tight, they can find a fellow molecule to combine with. Those free electrons can easily find another air molecule to combine with. In order for that electron to combine with that new air molecule, he's got to jump through those individual steps of excitation. If you did it the other way around, to excite a molecule, you're making the electrons jump to a higher and higher orbit. In order for him to regain a particular molecule, he's got to jump through those exact same steps to go back down. As he makes each one of those quantum steps of radius of his orbit, he's giving off an extremely characteristic piece of light. If you put an optical spectrum analyzer on that spark gap, you would see those individual spectral lines of that electron hopping back down to those lower energy states as he recombines, as he deionizes, and a tremendous amount of them are deionizing every microsecond in that spark gap. That's my guess. N2XJN, K2LIW.
Dick, you are not only the tough one, but the smart one. Got it. Yes, I agree with you. it means, and correct me if I'm wrong, please, that anything at any frequency will create a mechanical impact on anything that is charged or radio wave will create the mechanical impact on the atmosphere. Back to you.
I think you're right. Let me add to your experiment. Let's assume that I'm making a spark gap right now, and I've spread the two electrodes apart by a couple of inches, and I've increased the voltage so that the spark gap is being maintained. And now I aim a radio wave at that spark gap. I will get the response out of that radio wave as if I had a piece of wire between those two electrodes. That spark gap is a plasma. That plasma is conducting. It's continuously conducting current, and whether I call it a spark gap, whether I call it a spark that's doing the conducting, or whether I call it a piece of wire that's doing the conducting, to some degree, the radio wave that I aim at that spark is going to behave in a similar manner. It's a conducting medium. The RF wave has a certain number of volts per meter. The RF wave itself increases and decreases the conduction on each half cycle. When it's in the same direction as the spark, I increase the current, the radio wave does. Any other direction, it decreases it. So if I could look fast enough with a very high-speed optical instrument, I could see the glow of the spark getting hotter and colder on each half cycle of the RF wave. Once you've got a conducting medium, and the radio wave creates some number of volts per meter, I've now got a mechanism of coupling one into the other. So therefore, in my mind, a radio wave can easily couple into a ionized medium. It can easily couple into a plasma, as if it was a partial conductor. It's a semiconductor. N2XJN, K2RIW.
Okay, so do you think that there is any specific frequency of extra low frequency band from the HARP system that is applied to create aurora? Or just because of the fact that HARP is there, there will be the aurora change? Back to you.
I think that HARP chose its frequency of operation using two criteria. Number one, at what frequency do I have transistors and tubes and whatever that can generate a whole lot of power? Number two, at what frequency can I make a good phased array? At the VHF and UHF frequencies, I can make a very sharp, high-gain phased array by setting up a whole lot of those elements and feeding power to them at the right amplitude and phase angle. Maybe I can develop a whole lot of energy at 10 kilohertz, but at 10 kilohertz, I can't make a phased array that is 10 wavelengths wide and 10 wavelengths long. That would take up too many miles. So there's a conflict, there's a trade-off. The higher the frequency, the better the phased array I can make with 1 acre of property, let's say. The lower the frequency, the more energy I can create in the devices I have that I can buy. Somewhere in between, they chose a happy medium. Once you have a plasma, which is a conducting gas, the frequency you pour into it doesn't matter. The radio wave is creating a certain number of cyclic volts per meter that are coupling energy into that conducting plasma called ionosphere, and to some degree, I don't think the frequency matters. As long as it's low enough in frequency where the ionosphere will respond. Over to you, Wesley, K2RIW. Those are a bunch of guesses.
Hey, well, would you explain, it makes a lot of sense, and yes, I agree, but at the same time, you contradict anything that we know about the resonance, where you can use very low power in order to create enormous, humongous impact, like power of one man to create the resonance of the bridge, theoretically. But we saw that also in American bridges falling down because of the wind. But in a micro scale, we can create something by using only the resonance. So my understanding is that there has to be something that has something to do with the resonance, not only the power transmitted. Back to you.
Yeah, resonance is very handy, but there's a catch. It's fairly well known that the lowest frequency of resonance of oxygen molecules, nitrogen molecules, and so on, the first oxygen resonance is around 60 gigahertz. And they would like to build a phased array at 60 gigahertz, but the transmission lines would be very lossy, and you can't generate megawatts at 60 gigahertz with the available equipment and the dollars they had on hand. So when it comes to individual gas molecules, I don't think any of them have any kind of resonance below approximately 60 gigahertz. That's what I've heard up till now. Over to you, Wesley, K2RIW.
Well, I'm waiting for the repeater to... Okay, so listen on the reverse frequency. Where is that gentleman who is messing with us?
Yeah, take your readings on the input, gentlemen.
Hey. I'm trying to find any correlation with that's what I'm looking for, the supposed frequency of the oscillation that should give me the best results was between 20 to 30 kilohertz, although some of the people experimented with 500 kilohertz, and some of them with the 50 hertz. Now, if you could just forget for the moment about the HARP program, but tell me what is so special with 50 hertz. Back to you.
What's so special?
Whatever you guys are hearing, whatever you guys are hearing on the input, please transmit it to the email address of rfi@limonk.org. rfi@limonk.org. Just tell us what you heard on the input, what direction of arrival, and how strong, and so on. I don't think resonance is involved here. It would be nice if you could get it, but I think it takes 60 gigahertz to get the first resonance of these air molecules. I've worked on a project that was looking for atmospheric effects by looking for the resonances, and all that equipment had to run greater than 20 gigahertz in order to find anything in any of the molecules in this atmosphere. And there, by the way, this was a spacecraft looking between ground and Earth, so it was looking through the total atmosphere, including the ionosphere. And there wasn't very much to look at when it comes to radio astronomy-like measurements below 60 gigahertz, and they wanted to go up to at least 176 gigahertz because there's a bunch of molecule resonances that the radio astronomers have discovered long time ago. So individual free molecules have got extremely high frequency resonances. John, I know you had another question you wanted to ask. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
KC2WGB. Yes, Dick, it has to do with an attenuator. It incremental steps of 1 dB from 0 to 101, manufactured by K, and the dB seems to be working fine, the attenuation, although I do not know the frequency that it'll work to. I need you to set up a lab experiment I can do the correct way to get the frequency capabilities of this particular attenuator. They have N connectors at both ends, so I'm assuming it goes up to 1 gig, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, once you've got a model number somewhere on the planet, even if the K company doesn't exist, I don't know if they do or not, somebody knows about that model number. And if you ask the question on the microwave reflector, for instance, that's the WA1MGA, Whiskey Alpha 1 Mike Golf Alpha, if I got it correct, Dr. Tom Williams. He's got this microwave reflector, and the 400 very serious guys in all the countries in the world get together periodically and are mailing emails back and forth to each other on this listserv called the microwave reflector. You go to his website, it'll tell you how to sign up. You simply ask that question, I've got a K model so-and-so, and they're out of business. I haven't got a data sheet. What's the maximum frequency it's rated for? That's one approach. I'm going to tell you a second approach.
I don't have a model number.
Yeah, but if it was something that was manufactured by K, and it wasn't a onesie laboratory curiosity, and you simply describe it as 3 inches long, 2 inches high, two type-in connectors, and it's dialable in 10 dB steps, 20 dB steps, and 1 dB steps, and so on, and it goes to 101 total, you describe that to guys, somebody's going to say, yeah, I got one of those. Another approach is to take it apart and look at it physically. A person with a good RFI, EYE, can say, hey, they use these kind of switches, and those switches are only good to this frequency. They use these kind of attenuating devices, like the really good ones. You take apart a Hewlett-Packard 0 to 18 gigahertz step attenuator, and I own a couple of those, and you look at it under your microscope, and you say, wow. It's got little bitty leaf spring gold-plated-like things that have to move a 16th of an inch to make contact. They're all 50-ohm strip line in the way they're physically set up. The actual attenuating elements are pi resistor elements built on some kind of high silicon glass, and each one of these attenuators is about a quarter of an inch square, and maybe a 32nd of an inch thick, and you can only see the pi attenuators under a microscope. Well, that thing has rather tight ripple specs all the way up to 18 gigs. So by the physical construction, you compare it against a Hewlett-Packard 355C or 355D, which only goes to 1 gig, because it's got very simple single-pole, double-throw switches on great big step attenuators inside for each one of its steps. So the physical layout will tell you within the nearest octave exactly what frequency it can go to. And by the way, you can use a step attenuator at any frequency you like. If it's rated to 1 gig, like a 355, and you must use it at 4 gigs, it's a very simple process.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
It's a very simple process for you to take your 1 gig rated Hewlett-Packard 355 step attenuator and use it at 4 gigs. All you've got to do is recalibrate it. Calibrate it at 4 gigs. If you've got a signal generator and a power meter that runs at 4 gigs, and you go through those steps, you make yourself a chart. And you'll find out that at 4.1 gigs where you're really using it, and you dial in 7 dB, you really get 8.5. That's good enough. And if it, as long as you can tolerate the input standing wave ratio and the output standing wave ratio. In the case of step attenuators, the exact amount of attenuation is what starts developing ripples first. The input visoir and the output visoir, that degrades very slowly. Until you really go to high frequencies, your input and output visoir are pretty good, and your amount of coupling becomes a little bit hairy versus frequency. It's got ripple through it, but that's calibratable. So it's not going to explode because you've gone beyond its rated frequency, if you know what I mean, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW, the TechNet.
Okay, very good, Dick. This looks like it may have been built by K for a specific application. It's well marked, except the model number's missing, but it does have bat switches, toggle switches. It doesn't have exotic switches, so I'm assuming it's not way up in the gigs.
Yeah, the inside of the 355, and I own a couple of K attenuators that have simple toggle switches on them. And I believe they're rated to either 500 megs or 1,000. Close enough. But you have with your instrumentation the ability to calibrate it. And even if you have to dial in 12 dB in order to get 17, once you build that calibration chart, you'll know what you're going to get. So there's not that much magic there. And so what they said, if you had the data sheet, it doesn't really matter. You'd be amazed how many times hams have done some very significant work by saying, data sheet, smater sheet. I don't give a damn. I want to use it at this frequency. I'm willing to suffer the slight disadvantage of using it at that frequency. You'd be amazed how many times hams have taken coaxial cable with the manufacturer. The chart ends at 1,200 megs, and they're using it at 2,400. And as long as they're willing to tune the length and live with a couple of crazy idiosyncrasies, it works like a charm. So don't let that data sheet, if you had it, intimidate you. Back to you, John.
All right, Dick. Well, that sounds encouraging. I have quite a few, and this one was just annoying me because I didn't know. It doesn't look like any of the other things that I have made out of solid brass. It's a beauty. But thank you for the information, and I'm going to try that. I thought there was a simple way I could set up a bathtub curve or something like that with the scope and a generator.
Oh, without a doubt. You can sweep it. In other words, if this is the best of all worlds, you've got a network analyzer, and you've got the network analyzer displaying two curves on the screen simultaneously. Yellow and blue are my favorite curves. Yellow is measuring S11. That really means input reflection coefficient, which really is the first cousin of visoir. So yellow curve is a 0 to 20 dB of input reflection coefficient, we'll say. And the blue curve is S21, forward transfer voltage characteristic, displayed in decibels. So now you sweep it from DC to light on your network analyzer, and on your curves, you've got a yellow curve and a blue curve that tells you at each frequency what is its visoir and what is its gain, or what is its loss. And now, unfortunately, you've got to make a whole lot of those pictures, and you record them on your hard drive. You make a whole lot of those pictures for each one of the steps, or maybe you tune every 10 dB at first and every 5 dB at the end, or vice versa. There's various ways you can do it, but with a network analyzer, and you take a bunch of equivalent photographs off that screen, it'll tell you want to know. And most SEP attenuators, I'm pushing my luck a little bit now, I was about to say the input standing wave ratio and the output standing wave ratio are almost the same. Not quite true. Not quite true. If you want to be really thorough, then you have three curves on the screen. S11, that's input reflection coefficient. S21, that's forward gain. And S22, that's output reflection coefficient. So you got three colors on the screen, and you take a picture for each step setting, and you sweep it across all the frequencies you care about. That's every piece of data you ever wanted to dream about, all on those pictures. Everything you care about is going to be there. Over to you, John.
Okay, Dick. That sounds very good. Very interesting. I will put it through my signal analyzer and my spectrum analyzer, and I'll see what comes up. That'll probably be the easiest way to do it. But I just didn't want to not use it because I thought I was going to go out of range with it and not be able to rely on the attenuation factors. But perfect information. Thank you. KC2WGB. Back to net.
Yeah, if the thing is properly constructed, it should be repeatable. In other words, every time you dial in 7 dB, and at your particular frequency, you get an insertion loss of 8.5, it should give you 8.5 every time. I will admit, as you go higher and higher in frequency, with simple toggle switches, you may get a little bit of non-repeatability. You flip the toggle switch three times in a row, and you're going to see a slight difference. When you're at the upper frequency region where it just barely works, the way those contacts bounce and finally settle together, it's going to make a little bit of difference. You flip it three times in a row, and you're going to measure 8.5, 8.5, 8.4. Close enough. And again, by watching the screen as you flip the switch, you'll find out what the repeatability is. But it's all calibratable, and there's no absolutes. When it comes to the maximum frequency you can use the antenna, the maximum frequency you can use the transmission line, the maximum frequency you can use the step attenuator, the maximum frequency at which you can use this amplifier. You'd be amazed how many times I picked up a solid-state amplifier rated for 2.4 gigs. It still had a moderate amount of gain left at 5.5 gigs, and that's where I used it. Maybe a little bit higher in noise figure, but it did the job. So there are very few things in this world that are absolute if you've got enough test equipment. And you and Wesley are in the process of getting more than enough test equipment. I'm going to have to leave you guys pretty soon. Wesley, for any final comments, N2XJN, if you're still there, K2LIW.
Yeah, I'm here. I'll just have one more question about it. I believe you don't have strength to answer. What's so special in 50 hertz?
When it comes to transmitting AC power, after you listen to Tesla and Westinghouse, and you come to the conclusion that AC is a lot better than DC with the equipment they had in those days. And that's slowly changing. Really long-range transmission of high energy is being transmitted with megavolt of DC. And that's what the Canadian Hydro is doing right now. But once you settle on AC, you've now got to choose a frequency that's high enough that the transformer doesn't have to be huge. By the way, once you've got AC, you're going to be using transformers. You're going to step it up to high voltage to transmit it. You're going to step it down to lower voltages where you use it in the houses and the factories. And the higher voltage, the more the efficiency, with exceptions. So if you go to a real low frequency, you need a great big chunk of iron. If you go to a real high frequency, you get a lot of capacitive loading effects, and now all the laminations of the iron have to be very skinny so you don't get eddy currents. So there's a trade-off, just like everything else in life. Too low, it's too hard to build with a whole lot of iron. Too high, you get too much loss in the iron that's inexpensive. So whether it be 50 hertz or 60 hertz, whether you drive on the left side of the road or the right side of the road, that's your definition. And when it comes to transmission lines, there's nothing magic about 50 ohms. The Europeans think 70 ohms is a much better number. We think 50 ohms is a better number. 70 ohms, let me drop. With air-insulated coaxial cable, 70 ohms gives you the minimum amount of loss. 35 ohms gives you the maximum amount of power that you can transmit for a given diameter of cable. And 50 ohms is somewhere between those two. That's one way of looking at it. Another way of looking at it is if you're using the coaxial cable to make resonators, you get the highest impedance of the resonator if you make the coaxial cable, I think it was something like 90 ohms. So there's a whole bunch of trade-offs. So 50 and 70, they're both good numbers, somewhere in the middle of the bathtub curve. When it comes to the power generating frequency, 50 versus 60, it's a compromise. There's nothing magic about it. There's no earth resonance at 50 hertz or 60 hertz that they chose. It's just a convenient number somewhere in the middle of the constraints they had to work with. That's my guess, though, Wesley. N2XJN, K2RIW.
So you say Tesla was the first one who came with 50 hertz?
No, I didn't say that. All I said is Westinghouse and Tesla were telling you that when it comes to transmitting power over a long period, a long distance, AC was way superior to DC in those days with the hardware they had to operate with. The great big high voltage silicon control rectifiers and silicon control switches that we have today that can convert 500 megavolts of DC back into 60 cycle AC or 50 hertz AC, they didn't have those components. So AC is better than DC. And I don't know whether or not Tesla or Westinghouse chose 50 or 60 hertz. That's going to take some more research as to how that came about. And for all we know, it doesn't have a clearly defined father of that particular child. But back to you, Wesley, K2RIW.
Okay. Thank you very much. I thought that I'm going to hear more revelation, but that explains it. Thank you very much.
Yeah, this was TechNet number 1,328 of the numbering system we came up with a few years ago. Not exactly right. It's a little bit low, but close enough. We're going to stick with that numbering system. And this was hopefully the first of the series of the brand new TechNets, where with the first hour we treat a little bit better. We didn't do it completely right today, but we did it a little bit better. And with practice, we'll get better. What do you think, Mel? K2KEY, K2RIW.
Hey, this is K2KEY. Yeah, I think so. And the fact, if I remember correctly, I read someplace when you mentioned 50, 60 hertz, it was Westinghouse, I believe, who, in development of the AC motor, had something to do with it because of 1800 RPM motors and then 3600 RPM motors. I remember reading something like that, that it was multiple to the 60. But I'm not sure, but a long time ago, but something sticks in my mind in that neighborhood. All right, yeah, I think maybe we have a little better grip on the TechNet, so we'll continue with this. Everybody have a Merry Christmas if you celebrate the holiday, and we'll catch up with you next week. This is K2KEY saying goodnight to all.
Bye-bye, you guys. Keep your curiosity. Be kind to each other. See you down the road.
Thank you, Dick, very much, and don't forget about asking your guy about the color screen devices.
That I will. I'll see him tomorrow. His name is Mark, so I'll be asking Mark the question tomorrow. Bye-bye.
Good night, Dick. Good night, Mel, and thank you, guys. Good night, Wesley.
Good night, Jack. I'm sorry. I was eating. Good night, John, and good night, Mel.
Have a Merry Christmas, guys.
7310, have a good night, Dick.
John, are you still there?
Yes, I am, Wes.
I didn't finish the concrete. I ran out of bags. So I ran to the Home Depot and I found out that around 9 o'clock. And I found out that they're closed at 8. So the floor is done. Two walls are done. Just two walls to fill up. Probably four bags.
Teacher, well. Bernie recognized. Very good, Wes. So tomorrow should be a short day for you. And it should be set up enough for you to work around it.
Yeah. Bernie, pick up.
Wes, which Home Depot did you go to?
the one cross section Woodhaven and Metropolitan Avenue?
Because I think the one up towards up College Point Boulevard, just on the east side of the park, I believe is open till 10.
Now it's too late. And the helper that I had, he wanted to go home, so I gave up. We just clean up the mixer, and but the floor is perfectly leveled. The job was beautifully done. I'm complimenting myself, John.
Did they have the Portland cement for you to mix in? Did they have everything you needed?
No, John. They didn't have a Portland cement. Can you believe that?
Yeah, with the price of number one, it's kind of expensive now. That's probably why they don't stock it. Nobody knows what to do with it anymore anyway.
Ernie, do you have any experience with cementing concrete, making concrete?
Very limited. I just recently had to fill cinder blocks with concrete, as odd as that sounds. I was patching a hole in the floor, but I do know that in large quantities it's a pain to work with. You did the right thing by getting a mixer. Years ago I helped a buddy lay some in his garage. He did it by hand, and boy, it was a lot of work. So congratulations on your successful project. What?
Thank you very much. Well, yes, I've got a very small mixer, a plastic bucket. It's a good one. It's flippable, so you can flip it vertically and pour the cement into it, then put the water in it, and then simply put it on its original position, and it's working pretty good. The guy, when I was renting, it's 60 bucks, no, 40 bucks per day. That's from, he said, are you going to be using extension cords? Because it's going to be toasted. So the extension cord is going to be overheated. Well, guess what? I did use the extension cord, and no overheating was present. So, anyhow. Tomorrow another 2-3 hours of work and I'm done. And it looks like it's really, really nice coming out. John?
Yeah, the heating of the extension cord has to do with its length. You know, the longer it is, the more it heats up. But what he's afraid of, if it's too long, you'll burn the motor out. Over to you, Bernie.
And a lot of people don't have the kind of electrical knowledge that you have, Wesley. They probably just use some of that white zip cord stuff and wonder why the smoke's coming off the cord. Either of you guys, any good with coax strippers?
Yeah, well, RG59, RG6, that is the most that I was doing, but the typical ham radio coaxial cables, which comes from different kind of thicknesses. I was doing that. Everybody was doing that. That was quite a time ago. The last time, I believe, last year. John?
Yeah, on the job, we used to have the automatic strippers that you just stuck it in. We stepped on a pedal and it heated, cut it, and did everything. So it was a lot easier than the hand ones they have today. But if you're doing like RG8, you can use razor blade. That usually works well if you're only doing one or two connections.
Now I've got a pile of crimp on PL-259s, and they're going on RG-58. And I'm looking at all the strippers I've got, and I've got nothing that strips a pattern anywhere close to that. So I think I'm going to have to call the manufacturer tomorrow and find out do they have a preference brand and model of stripper that will do that kind of strip for these connectors. Wes?
It's RG59, then I have a special stripper. You just put a tool on it, press the handle, and it's done. Then you change to a smaller hole, and you expose the inner wire. That's for RG59. 86, I do have the special one. I have no problem to give it to you. It's extremely nice tool. But as far as 50H, John, I don't really recall. 58 is thinner probably than 59, but you...
on the particle length of the
additional burning, the ferrule, the outside ferrule that you're going to crimp for the braid, is that the quarter-inch one in width, or is it the three-quarter-inch crimp? And second of all, I would pre-tin the center conductor before you put it in anyway.
Yes, you guys mentioned that. I was taking a look at the center conductor, and it's got pretty good clearance to be able to get through, but I may just tin it to help it ahead of time so I don't have to get it near as hot when I go to solder it. The crimp die on the ferrule is a 0.213, so it probably starts at about 225, somewhere around there. By the time it comes back around me, I'll have a mic on it. But that's the die set is 0.213. Wes?
I meant the length of the ferrule. Some of them are only like a quarter inch that you crimp, and others are like three quarters of an inch long.
Look in the middle of inside the connector, and you're going to see how much of that you need.
And I'm busy miking. The ferrule is basically half an inch long, and I don't have the outside measurement of it, but it's half inch long, John.
Okay, yeah, that's the better ferrule, so you'll be all right with that. And if it's all copper braid, probably 95% shield. Yeah, as long as you tin the center conductor, it'll the capillary action will work much better when you try to center side of that center pin.
Well, I think I'm going to head upstairs, get on the internet, and the connectors are made by RF connectors. Not the best in the world, but open up the forest. I'm a fan of amps, but didn't have access to amp ones, so these are what I have. The cable's also pretty good quality, it's Belden, so it should work out pretty well.
And what is exactly the purpose of you making four of the cables at the same length?
Working on the antenna array for my Doppler unit. My car died, so I had to get a new car, and the new car can't use mag mounts anymore. So I have to change my Doppler array to be on a plate versus previously where they were independent mag mounts that you set up on the roof. So the plate's all set up, got everything drilled on it, etc., but now I need to connect the antenna mounts to the center switcher. And critical that those be as exact as possible. Not that critical how long they are, but it's extremely critical that they're the same length.
Yeah, well, John, are you thinking also about pulling Doppler? So you would be able to take control of the jammer?
Yes, in fact, they're working on a system that might be mounted on my lab here, right on the roof. We're going to see how that goes so that I can give them directivity and pretty instant, because there's a couple of problems with the system I was working on, not only with reflections, but the timing signals are not going to give me enough time. The Doppler is almost immediate access when they key up, like within a couple of microseconds.
Yeah, this is for our competitive stuff, for our Friday night hunts. Although it's kind of cold to be hunting, right? Actually, hunting is fine. Nobody wants to hide. It's kind of cold outside.
John is a polar bear. His blood is originated from Normandy and from the area of cold, close to Poland. John?
Remember, we weren't Germans, we're Bavarians.
Well, I'm an Irishman, we're just used to rain, and it's the rain and overcast.
Yeah, I was thinking, would I actually put German to be a friend of Jew?
Must have been from the war. What else?
Hey, there's a whole lot of German Jews. A buddy of mine is highly German. His name is Schweiger. He is Jewish. So, yeah, there were many German Jews until until the Nazis came along.
Yeah, well, it must be something... I don't know if it's in the blood or maybe just coincidence. Bernie, did you notice the way that John talks? Always calm, and he has that very, very nice, smooth sound. And I remember in Germany, when I was in Germany, that's what they use. They might be a little bit faster with talking than John is, but this kind of very, very low voice, and it's always the same low. Bernie?
So I agree with you. It is a bit odd. I kind of picture John sitting in a big leatherback chair with a smoking jacket, probably a brandy in one hand and a microphone in the other hand. He's got that kind of laid-back radio kind of voice, John.
Boy, Bernie, you got my number, that's for sure. Little Louis the 14th and a nice cigar. You got it. Now, Wesley knows. I enjoy myself. I worked enough years, so now I'm just kicking back and doing exactly what you said. I'm really enjoying myself. I'm having a lot of fun. And with all you great guys on this repeater, it's the past year has been a pleasure. Wes, pick it up.
Guys, we have 2 minutes. So, before the repeater is going to be switched off by the direction of higher authority. So, thank you for chatting with me, and a beautiful evening that I have spent with you guys. I was trying to take advantage of Dick and trying to put him into the logical cage. No, I wasn't successful. This guy is really brilliant. John?
Well, that's why I enjoy the repeater. Dick is one of the big things. Mel, all the guys, I love talking to intelligent people who really, you know, they're well-grounded and they're not trying to put anything over on anybody. It's just a bunch of great guys here. Over to you, Bernie.
Well, as Dick says, that's just one of the 43 different types of ham radio. And don't worry, Wesley, some of us are working on trying to get this repeater to be open all night. One day we'll get around to it and get it done. John, come summertime, we'll have to get together and have a good brandy and a cigar or something. But sure not in this weather. On the left.
Okay. Yeah, I love his cigars. He's got a good one. And he actually taught me how to smoke a cigar. And I think I was a good student, John.
Yes, you were. And you kept it lit, too. First-timers have a hard time doing that. Well, I'm going to say 73, guys. It's a pleasure. Bernie, you enjoy the evening. You too, Wesley. Say hello to Anya.
Well, John, we corrupted another one. Good job. 73, guys. Catch you guys later. I'm going to run upstairs, look this up on the internet, and then probably hit the rack. Always a wonderful conversation, guys. Wes, congratulations on your project, and we'll catch you guys later. KTYO is clear.
The time is 1 a.m. 73, and good night from the WQVL repeater. Net tonight at 8:30 W2VL repeater system. The time is 1:23 a.m. 73, and good night from the W2VL repeater. Net tonight at 8:30. Welcome to the W2VL repeater.
Amateur Radio Newsline Report, number 1740, with a release date of Friday, December 17th, 2010, to follow in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. The following is a QST. Hams in Hawaii are ready as a Pacific storm hits the island state. A New Brunswick cell phone law could ban amateur radio mobile operations. The long-awaited Jarvis Island expedition is put on hold until November of 2011, and Ohio Hams provide the technology to improve the sheriff's radio system. All this and more on Amateur Radio Newsline Report number 1740, coming your way right now.
From around the world, this is Newsline, Amateur Radio's first independent on-the-air news and bulletin service. Now reporting from Auckland, New Zealand, here is Jim Meacham, ZL2BHF.
Hands in Hawaii were ready as a major Pacific storm wreaked itself over the island state. Bill Pasternak, WA6ITF, is in the newsroom with more.
The warning is issued until 4:15 a.m. Standard Time at 1:20. Radar showed a line of heavy showers and thunderstorms moving over Molokai from the northwest, with rainfall rates as high as 3 to 4 inches per hour. Heavy rain will start over western Molokai.
That's the sound of ham radio racing and Skywatch operations as a strong Pacific storm moved over Hawaii on December 9th and 10th, bringing with it heavy rain, accompanied by thunder and lightning. According to news reports, worst hit was Oahu and Kauai, with gusty winds taking down trees in several areas. Ron Hashiro, AH6RH, is the Hawaii State Civil Defense Racing Coordinator and an accredited Skywarn member. He explains the system that caused the severe storm to hit the island state.
Well, what we had was cold front was through the system and flooding up against the warm air that was at the south east. And as the storm front came through, it produced a collection of thunderstorms, and that was sweeping through Kauai, going through Oahu, and heading down further down south into the east of the Big Chief.
Hashiro told Newsline that the National Weather Service needed severe weather spotters all across the island state, and the hams were ready to respond.
Ray Tanabe, who is also a ham, W7IH, contact our one of our contacts at State Civil Defense and asked us to activate Skywarn. And so Clem Jung, J7HO, contacted a number of hams on Oahu and put together a response team and had people scheduled from 6 p.m. on Thursday all the way through into Friday evening.
According to Hashiro, the ham radio volunteers were both communicators and severe weather spotters.
We provided radio communication at the National Weather Service office in Honolulu, and a number of hams at home or on the road called in weather reports, whether it was a tremendous amount of rain, lightning, thunder, or and the wind condition, something that the National Weather Service can't quite pick up on is what is the wind speed on the ground and what is the total amount of lightning that's present in the given area. So therefore, weather spotting and observers are a very important part of the collection of information on weather conditions.
As hams did their job, Honolulu fire crews worked to clear what was left of a roof of a plumbing supply company that had been sheared off by the storm. Officials said that the overnight gusty winds blew open the large warehouse door and then lifted the roof off. Some 3,000 feet of roofing material was taken off, with some parts of it landing several blocks away on the famed Nimitz Highway. With thanks to former Newsline production coordinator Bill Orenstein, KH6QX, for the on-the-scene audio, I'm Bill Pasternak, WA6ITF in the newsroom in the City of Angels, reporting for the Amateur Radio Newsline.
Thanks to the ongoing training that many hams in Hawaii devote themselves to, everyone was ready to handle the latest challenge that Mother Nature brought their way. The United Kingdom's government is looking for 500 megahertz of spectrum, and this could spell problems ahead for hams in that nation. The British newspaper The Register recently carried a story on government plans to reallocate as much as 500 megahertz of spectrum for broadband internet. The article points out that if large chunks of Ministry of Defence spectrum are sold off, the new owners are unlikely to be willing to share it with others. The problem for UK hams comes from the fact that all amateur radio UHF and microwave bands are shared with either the Ministry of Defence or the UK Civil Aviation Authority. If some of the spectrum that gets reallocated happens to be shared with radio amateurs, it's quite likely that the hams will be forced off those bands. Those interested can read the entire Register article at tinyurl.com/28AYVZL. Thanks to the efforts of the Spanish Amateur Radio Society, the URE, hams in that nation now have access to three new microwave bands. These are 2320 to 2322, 5760 to 5762, and 10368 to 10370 megahertz. Amateur use of the spectrum has been authorized for a year. However, those intending to use 2320 to 2322 must first inform the nation's telecommunications regulator. More on this regulatory change in Spain in Google Translated English is online at tinyurl.com/SpainURE. The Canadian province of New Brunswick has introduced legislation banning cellular telephone and two-way radio use while mobile. Amateur Radio Newsline's Norm Seeley, KI7UP, has the details.
The measure was introduced in the New Brunswick legislature on November 24th. Its aim is to control cell phone and any other hand-operated electronic device use while driving. As worded, it would prevent radio amateurs from using their mobile radios while in motion. Now, in a letter to the Brunswick Minister of Public Safety, Robert Trevors, the National Society Radio Amateurs of Canada has taken strong opposition to the proposed law. In its communique to Trevors, RAC notes that most provinces, such as Nova Scotia, Manitoba, British Columbia, Quebec, Newfoundland, and Labrador, have chosen not to restrict the operation of mobile amateur radio equipment while driving. RAC notes that these governments have recognized the value of amateur radio to their citizens during such emergencies such as floods, dangerous weather, and ice storms. Also noted is the support by Canadian hams in support of public events such as marathons and of emergency relief groups such as the Red Cross and a variety of provincial and municipal agencies across Canada. RAC adds that this support provided by amateur radio is frequent, freely given, and in the highest standard of public service. The letter goes on to state that hams in New Brunswick regularly and without fail respond to the province's citizens' needs. This includes helping municipalities fighting floods along the St. John's River. The note ends by warning New Brunswick legislators that eliminating the use of federally certified Canadian radio amateurs to use mobile radio equipment will not increase public safety, but will decrease it. The third reading of the bill is expected during the week of about the time this newscast goes to air. After that, the bill permits the New Brunswick government to proclaim the legislation at a time of its choosing any time thereafter. For the Amateur Radio Newsline, I'm Norm Seeley, KI7UP, watching the events up north from here in Scottsdale, Arizona.
Radio Amateurs of Canada says that it's preferable that any exclusions for amateur radio operators occur in the legislation itself, as it has requested. However, it notes that there are provisions for a regulated exclusion for radio amateurs under Canadian law. This states that the Lieutenant Governor in Council may make regulations exempting, with or without conditions, certain classes or types of devices or motor vehicles, or certain classes of persons. Read the latter as referring to Canadian hams. This week, coming to you from Down Under, we are the Amateur Radio Newsline, heard on bulletin stations around the world, including the W7CSK repeater serving Everett, Washington. The day expedition to Jarvis Island, organized by Radio Expeditions Incorporated, has been postponed until November 2011. The reasons are complex, but boil down to it taking authorities too long to come up with a plan acceptable to all parties, and then getting it approved through all the bureaucratic red tape. Once it was in place, several groups qualified under it, so more time was spent in holding a lottery to decide which group would be permitted to go. While Radio Expeditions Incorporated was fortunate to be the group selected in late August, it soon became apparent that due to all these factors, plus scheduling transportation to Jarvis, that it was best for all involved that the expedition be postponed 1 year. November remains the best month to visit Jarvis Island from a propagation standpoint, with the largest combination of openings predicted to Europe on the HF band. This being the case, the new plan is for the operation to take place in November of 2011, with exact dates to be announced.
ham radio operators have volunteered their time and technical expertise